Hello and welcome to Pond Jumpers, the international podcast for open source developers. This is episode number 8, 7 Reasons to Use Spring, presented at the National Java Users Group, October 21st, 2010.
So whatever, I'm a senior software engineer at SpringSource, and SpringSource was bought up by VMware last year, and SpringSource does a lot of Java-based development. And what this is sort of a technical explanation about Spring, as in seven big reasons why Spring would be of benefit to you. So first of all, a little bit about me is I've worked in the software industry for 13 years now. One project, I do lead an open source project called Spring Python. That actually takes the concepts of the Spring framework and implements them in Python. It's not a direct port job, but instead kind of looks at the underlying architecture and concepts and implements them in the Python framework. My primary job at SpringSource is I'm part of the TC Server team. TC Server is a commercialized version of Tomcat server container. So I don't know if you've heard of Tomcat. It's an Apache Software Foundation project. So TC Server takes Tomcat and adds some extra commercialized jar files to it to add extra control and management. And I've also contributed to some existing open source frameworks like MythTV, MediaWiki, and CG Security, which is now called Spring Security. And I'm also an author, so I actually wrote a book called Spring Python 1.1 and was published earlier this year, and I'm writing another one currently. But the real thing is to talk about Spring. Now, the idea of Spring starts from when J2EE came out several years ago. It was sort of a new standard for building web-based Java applications, and many aspects of it were complex and bulky, and people had challenges with implementing it, or sometimes they over-engineered solutions. And the idea of Spring was the original creators of it, they wanted to reduce the complexity of that. You know, their ways to make things easier. Sometimes people used EJBs because EJBs existed, whereas you don't always need EJBs to solve problems. People ran into testability issues, for instance, like apps that were built against the J2E spec for unit test purposes. The only kind of testing you could do had to be inside the app server container because you depended on certain services being in existence for your code to tap. So the concept of Spring was to simplify without giving up any of that power and to look at what are some best practices. Like a lot of people that were using J2E maybe were not experts in what was good strategy and what was bad strategy. And so some of the most proficient experts were working at Spring. And a lot of it was from the get-go, it was an open source project, so there was a lot of feedback into the project, and it grew from practical experience. Now, how to do that was the real thing. It's kind of based on this idea of working with POJOs. And next slide will talk a little bit more about what POJOs are if you haven't heard about that. But a POJO is a plain old Java object. In other words, a simple class that's not extending part of like the J2E spec or something. The idea is simple classes should be simple to use and simple to operate on. And the idea is you want to take enterprise-level services and be able to apply them to the POJOs, like transactions or JMX or there's other classes that were made to support entity beans to be stored into databases. So the idea is to write simpler code that isn't dependent on the app server container. And to kind of drill that a little bit more, the POJOs, they're not bound to any environment. You know, if you build a POJO-based application, you should be able to use the POJO whether it's inside an app server or outside an app server. You know, one example being like in a JUnit test. You know, if you're writing automated testing and you want to be able to exercise the POJOs, if that POJO is extending an EJB home interface that requires the server container to be online, then it's no longer a POJO. It requires both the class and its backup stuff. And another piece of that you get into is you talk about environment specific stuff. You know, if I build this application and I deploy it in an app server in the dev lab, you know, in the development lab, you know, I may have one set of configurations, but if I go drop that server, if I go drop the code into a production app server, I may run into issues where I have different entries, like you do JNDI lookups, for instance. You know, dev, I may have called it dev JMS connection, but, you know, in the production environment, it may be production JMS connection pool or something like that. So you've got this environment dependency when you move different environments. That is to, you want to avoid that kind of stuff so your app becomes more portable. And it's the idea is the services that you're getting, you need, there's another strategy to use so that you're not having to go hard code this lookup into the app server, and it's called dependency injection, where you know you're dependent on the service, but you should have it injected into you instead of you going out and getting it. That way, you can have different configurations, and it doesn't matter. You know, your code doesn't care where it got the dependency, just that somebody gave it to it. You know, one of the biggest things that this leads to is the ability to test outside of the container, because now I can go into an automated test and create like a mocked version of the JNDI service that I'm going to push into it. And I got some sample code to look at it. You know what this means exactly. So there's some code samples coming, but one key benefit of Spring is it's a modular solution. There's a lot of little pieces that Spring comes with. I was just making reference to things like dependency injection. Earlier we mentioned transactional and also JMX parts. There's a lot of different utilities and services that Spring brings to the table, and what it doesn't require you to adopt the whole solution. For instance, a comparison would be if you wrote an app and you based it on struts, or use something like Wicket. It is, you got to use the whole solution. You can't code half your application against struts and half of it not against struts. You kind of have to embrace their whole framework. With Spring, it's a more modular solution. So, you know, today I can start with this piece and experiment with it and find out that this is providing me value, and I want to go now learn this other part of Spring that I read about that looks beneficial. You know, and then what I start to find out is, well, these two actually do work good together. You know, they're designed to interoperate with each other, but I don't have to use it all. So I'm going to go in here now. I got 7 reasons, and I'm going to kind of walk through them, each of them with some code examples. And the first one's called dependency injection. So the case for dependency injection. All of our applications, whatever components we build, they all have dependencies on other services. We need our application code needs to talk to things, and the idea is how to get a hold of them. There's a lot of different ways you can pull in, you know, the way your component can pull in what it needs to do. It could do a JNDI lookup to go find a particular data resource that's defined in the app server. It may find the information to connect to the database in a prop file. Or some people have written what's called the service locator pattern that has become an anti-pattern. So what people started doing is they were coding a service locator here, and then it was like, oh, well, I need a service locator here, and I need one here, and you start writing it kind of the same boilerplate code solution all over the place. And when you write the same code in multiple places, it's trouble, because if you modify it in one place, you've got to remember to modify it everywhere. And another key problem with this is it's hard to test, because you've baked into the code how you're getting that service. So the code isn't flexible that I can swap out the real service with, say, a test dummy. So the solution for all this is a pattern called dependency injection, which is, rather than looking up the dependencies, we want someone else to push the dependencies to us. Instead of us going out and pulling for them, we want an independent component to push them into us. And that's what Spring does. So here I got a diagram that kind of shows what I'm talking about here. There's this concept that Spring calls an application context. And it's, I don't think that impacts that. Oh, I see. Okay. There's this thing called an application context, and you know, the idea is you. There we go. That is, you define a set of there's a set of pieces in here, and the idea is this is sort of like a like blueprints for a document. The idea of it's like you know, when you go build a house, you have a lot of components to assemble the house. You have doors, sheetrock, nails. These are all components that you can go buy the components at any store, but the idea is how you put them together defines the house that you're going to build. So when I say components, you know, I think about the application classes that we build or the POJOs. So in the application context, I'm going to define, and we'll see an example of what this looks like more concretely. We need to bring in the POJO classes. The next piece that we need is we need the configuration instructions. So when I talk about blueprint patterns, you know, there's directions about, well, we need a wall here and we need a wall here. So we know how to build walls. The blueprints tell us how to put them together and where to put them together. And then what happens when you merge these two together is you get a fully configured application that you can now run. Here's a code block here that here's where we define an interface called transfer service, and it's some kind of bank. You know, this is some kind of banking application. The idea is we need to transfer money from one account to another. So our implementation here, we've got this transfer service implementation, and it's dependent on the account repository. We need an account repository to access the account and do something. So the idea is, in this case, it's fed to us through a constructor call. So instead of this POJO, this transfer service, impl POJO service, going out and saying, JNDI, give me the account repository service, it's going to wait for somebody else to res it up and feed it an account repository service. So down here what we have is account repository is our interface. This is, say, for instance, a JDBC implementation of it. So this is one that's based off connecting to the database through, and to do its job. And what it needs is a data source object to connect to the database. So what we're going to show here is this is a Spring wiring document. This is what I would call an application context file. It's an XML. And here it's a collection of beans, and you notice there's three entries here. The top one is our transfer service. It has a name, and this is the class name that we're going to res up. And in this case, it has one constructor argument, and we're going to point it to an account repository bean. So if I look down at the second bean, its name is account repository, and it's an instance of that JDBC account repository that I just looked at on the previous slide. Now what account repository needed was a data source object. And that's where our third bean is defined, and it's an instance of the Oracle's JDBC data source. The data source has two setters that we need to supply it for it to be sufficient, and that's we need a URL and we need a user. And here, instead of having a reference to another bean, we have a concrete value. In this case, it's going to use a thin connection and connect to the money transfer app, or as the money transfer app user. You know what Spring is doing under the hood when you res this up in your application. You know, it basically looks at each of the beans. It's able to compute who's dependent on whom, and so it's going to go down and create this data source object first because it has no bean dependencies to anybody else. So it's going to create an instance of Oracle data source. It's then going to take this value and call setURL on it to populate the URL value, and it's going to call setUser on it like a Java bean property. You know, and it's going to be able to go up and see that account repository needs it, and it's going to call it and basically pass it a handle on the data source and then go and create the transfer service object. Now, one thing that we see about Spring, or we hear about it, that it shows up in the blogosphere is that Spring sucks. And these are comments that have been around since Spring was born, and that is because we're using XML. There's sort of an anti-XML movement afoot, and that may be because there are a lot of tools that were built with XML. that people are tired of managing with the tools and stuff. Or there's a lot of, and I think a lot of these tools have different dialects of XML. And so they're kind of like, can we just, we want to write Java code, let's stick with Java code and not use XML. So the idea to solve, to combat this is to point out that Spring is not constrained to just XML. What I showed in the first slide was that earlier one was an XML configuration file. There's also other options that Spring offers, and these are annotation-based configurations. So instead of building an XML file, you can get the same amount of metadata configured in different ways in the application. One thing is Spring has auto-wiring and jar scanning, so you can actually go annotate, and you have components, for instance, like the beans or whatever. You can go annotate that class that we first saw, the JDBC repository or JDBC service. You can put an annotation on it called @component, and then when you bring up your Spring environment, instead of having to specify with an XML file, Spring will go scan all your class files and find that entry and go and note to grab that object and put it into its context. There were some other JSRs that were created to add some more annotations that involved wiring, and the idea is basically Spring supports them all. I think there's another JSR 299 and 330 that have to do with dependency injection, and Spring was actually involved in the process of working on those JSRs. You know, let me show you an example of what I mean by annotations. This was that first POJO we defined with transfer service impl, and we can mark it as a component. So that means basically, you know, this class needs to be pulled into the context and made available in case there's another bean that needs an instance of transfer impl. What we've done is we've annotated the constructor call as @autowired, meaning when Spring reses this class up, it's going to say, wait a minute, we need to go find an account repository. We need some class that implements account repository and inject it in here when this class gets created by Spring. So that saves us from having to go write some of that explicit stuff that was in the XML file. Now, some of the newer stuff is there is some Java EE dependency injection that's out there. And part of this is, I believe Spring kind of came onto the scene back in 2004. There was a book written by Rod Johnson called... Enterprise Java without EJB, in that there were a lot of solutions that didn't really need to have EJBs necessarily. If you know, people tended to jump onto EJBs perhaps prematurely. But since then, a lot of people started to realize the wisdom of dependency injection, so they've been going back to update the J2E spec to start adding types of dependency injection. But you could say in this sense that Spring is sort of state-of-the-art and has been modifying itself with response to community versus response to committee of the JCP. Google created a dependency injection framework called Juice, which is pure annotation-based, and has some interesting comparisons in how to use that. And one thing is that, I guess here it points out, Java EE only allows injecting JNDI managed objects. So if you actually create a service but you don't register it with JNDI, it's not an injectable option with the Java EE dependency injection spec. However, with Spring, you can really kind of inject anything that you want to or need to. And the thing is, with that kind of power, you need to be cautious and not go, injection crazy, where you don't necessarily want everything to be a managed bean in Spring. You need to look at, what is something that's useful? What's something that I want to swap out maybe at test time, where I want to, instead of using a production database connection, I want to use a mock database connection. That's a key injection point that would be valuable to have, but certain other things that are not prone, are not prone to change or have configurable property file driven things, maybe you don't need to put that into your Spring context. So that's a little bit about dependency injection there. The next reason is it's a utility called JDBC template, and actually this is what kind of pulled me into Spring when I first started reading up about it. So I've been using Spring since about 2006, maybe late 2005. I heard some blog article about it, and I went and started reading up about it. And at the time, I was working with an application that was not written in Java, and we were looking at porting it to Java. This application had something like 200 or more SQL queries written. The idea was, I found out that this utility really was very pragmatic, because it's an alternative to object relational mapping. So I don't know if you're familiar with Hibernate, or I think there's some other tools out there where you it has to do with, instead of writing SQL code, you write this alternative type of query language, and it has mapping information to map into the tables. But it has to do with mapping data into objects and objects persisting them back out into databases without necessarily having to write complex SQL joins. So that's what the object relational mapping stuff is about. And it's a very popular thing, because people have been able to take very simple relationships, if you think of something like a library has one or more books, and a book has, books are related to authors, and books are related to subjects. So there's a kind of a simple relationship you can map into the database. And if you're building a web app around that, you don't want to spend all your effort writing some simple join statements. Instead, if you could define what that relationship is and how it relates to your POJO classes, you can then use something like Hibernate to say, well, I need to store this book into the database, or I need to pull this book out of the database, and with this book I want to look up the authors, or I want to go find out which library it's in. However, not everything quite fits into that simple object-based persistence model. Instead, we have to write SQL queries for kind of different data warehousing solutions. Like maybe you have batch jobs you have to perform. My old job, we had to tabulate a monthly report for the customer, to calculate the total bill, maybe basically send them a bill. We also had to calculate quarterly metrics and annual metrics, and these were things that really didn't fit the convention of, a POJO store in a database. And you also get into things like stored procedures. Those don't fit into the ORMs either. I think I remember at the DevLink conference, you had a particularly interesting data problem of having to access some strange data, or it was genetic-oriented data in a database that was stored in an awkward format. And I'm not sure that would really fit into an ORM solution. So, what I was talking about, let's look at some real code here. Well, this is what it looks like to run this query up here. Select first name A and age from person based on their last name. This is all the stuff you have to do to look up two columns in a database. However, when you start writing code, when you've written your 10th JDBC query, you start to notice you're writing the same pattern all the time. I kind of just sort of blur out the boilerplate. The stuff that's in bold is what I really care about. So the fact is I'm getting a list of people, and I'm not looking up one row, I'm looking up a list. I've got a unique query up there. I only care about the first name and the age. I already have the last name. I don't have to actually fetch the last name back because it was an argument. So I'm going to build up a list, and I'm just going to return back an array. So the idea is, what JDBC template does is it lets you kind of do all that. It basically does all that for you, and you get to focus on the important part. In this case, it has a query. This isn't the same query, it's a different one, but the idea is I'm going to query for an integer, and I'm expecting to get one value out of this, select count star from customer. And I've done that with plain old JDBC. I would have had to write all that boilerplate just to fetch one value. Oops. So it's like, you write this stuff, Spring does all the other part about getting the connection. This also impacts if you've got a transaction. So I haven't even showed the code what it does to put that stuff inside a transaction. Sifting through the results and also handling the exceptions. And probably the biggest benefit to JDBC JDBC template is the last bullet item, release of the connection. I don't know how many times I've seen systems where It's like database has run out of resources, and that's because somebody wrote a JDBC query and they forgot at the end to release the connection. So they ran out of connections to the database because the app was up all the time. Usually if you shut down the app server, it's going to release all the connections and suddenly your database springs to life. Now there's also, one thing is when Spring was started, Java was still at version 1.3. So they have a lot of backward support. So you can still get older versions of Spring, and if you buy a contract, they'll support it. Support some of the older versions, but when we got to Java 5, we were able to get to generics, so they created a version of JDBC template that used the generics and also the variable arguments option, the dot 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 ellipses that you can use, and they called it simple JDBC template, which I'm gonna, we got one of the queries that's using simple JDBC template here. Yeah, it's on this one. So here I've got a simple JDBC template. And in this case, it used to be that you'd get back an object and you have to cast it if you're using Java 1.4. But with Java 5, there's another option. We'll just expand it here with some code. So this is the original query we were doing, it's based on ID, not on last name. And what I need to do is I need a person mapper. So it needs to run the query, but as it goes through every row of data in the results set, I need it to process that row and hand me back a person object. So in this case, this person mapper implements, this is a Spring interface called parameterized row mapper, and it's a parameter. So here I've got the code to handle one row of data, and in this case I'm going to get a new person, I'm going to fetch out the first and second column, and then return that back. And what I'm going to get out of that at the top is it's going to hand me back, well, in this case, it's looking for one person, so it's going to hand back a person. But there's another query that says basically get simple JDBC template dot query. And in that case, I'm going to get back a list of persons. So that's JDBC template. Now there's a little more detail in there that we didn't quite get to on that previous code, and that's exception handling in JDBC. There are a lot of exceptions out there, and the places that you typically in this pattern catch them are either when you're trying to connect to the database and run your query, and at the end there's a chance that when you try to close it you may get an exception, and you have to handle that stuff. So if you can imagine that you've written this code and you've got 50 other queries in your system, so you've repeated this pattern n number of times, what options do you have when you start running into something like an Oracle-specific exception that happens? Like maybe there's some kind of deadlock situation and you need to handle it. You have to put extra catchers to catch that stuff in here if you're going to use JDBC. But maybe you want to define a different behavior. Like what do you want to do when you get an exception? Do you want to eat the exception and do nothing about it? Do you want to log it, email it, Twitter it, wrap it, maybe you want to do a retry. It depends on the situation, what happens. In this example, this is a specific Oracle error here. Whatever, it's this code, I guess it's called deadlock loser. Like I think if you're trying to connect and perform something and you're acting on a row of data that it has a collision with another thread acting on the same row of data, Oracle may vote you down and say you lost, you have to retry it after we've updated this row of data. And it throws you an ORA 00060. I wonder if it goes to sleep. It may not impact it. Well, you said it's cloned, so it may do that. Okay. This is a case where if you get the specific code, it's just basically calling that outer method again. So it's recalling it to try to try again. Try again. Otherwise, if it's a different code, you want to rethrow it up the chain and deal with it. And one thing about it is that's kind of ugly, and the fact that you would have to do it 50 times over for every instance of this query is also not very nice to deal with. That kind of violates this concept we call the dry principle. Don't repeat yourself, because anytime you repeat code, you're subject to breaking it if you don't update it everywhere. Another thing is it's not portable. Right now we're talking to Oracle. What if we migrated to SQL Server? Or if my manager says we can't afford Oracle, we're moving to PostgreSQL. We can afford a support contract with them much cheaper than what it costs to do Oracle. So I may no longer have this Aura 00060, but I still need to handle the deadlock. So now I gotta go look up what's there, what's a comparable error code for them, and add it in there, and I gotta handle the transition process. Now another feature that's built in is Spring has some exception translations that it handles inside that JDBC template. One is it has a what's called a deadlock loser exception, and it uses something we're gonna get some more slides about called AOP, or aspect oriented programming. Now this chart here is it's sort of an eye chart here, but there's one root exception that Spring defines called data access exception, and it's a runtime exception. So if something's gonna throw a data access exception, you don't have to catch it. You're not required to implement handling it like if you had something like an IO exception. But they have several subclasses here. And where's the one that they had? Deadlock loser data access exception. I'm gonna stay here. So what they've built into the Spring template is it's able to, based on what you've connected to, it'll sniff that you've connected to Oracle, and it looks for certain error codes and will translate them. So when it catches the exception, it looks up the error code, says, oh, that's an 060 throw deadlock loser data access exception. Because it's a runtime exception, it can get boiled up to where you're actually making the JDBC template call, and you can trap for that and say, oh, if I get that one, I'm going to retry it. And whether I put, you know, when I go to PostgreSQL and change my data source connection for that one, it's going to be able to look up the code for that. So it's going to handle it in either environment without me having to change my source code. You know, we can detect, there's a lot of other things to we can detect to handle. And you can go define your own mapping, in fact. Maybe I've had the case where you had to detect a certain specific type of error and retry three times, and after that, give up. So you actually have the ability to go in and extend that with Spring. The fourth one I'm going to mention is called aspect-oriented programming. I don't know if you've heard of that or have read anything about that. Maybe you've heard the words or something, but what is AOP? It's we'll talk about it, and I've got some more details to show some examples of. It's a modularization of cross-cutting concerns. What is a cross-cutting concern? It's some kind of generic functionality that you need to apply in several different places that has absolutely nothing to do with your object-oriented hierarchy. I try to think of, you know, you have a base class and you create subclasses and sub-subclasses, or you have an interface with concrete members, but you have different hierarchies of classes, but you've got some functionality that kind of transcends that. Some examples are things like logging and tracing. You know, it's the idea where I want to write sort of some special logging based on certain conditions, and even if I go put it up in a base class so that all my subclasses inherit it, it doesn't cover it for this other hierarchy that may be unrelated to that. So, you know, instead of trying to go put some superclass above everything, AOP is a simpler solution. Another example is things like transactions and security and caching. I'll show an example requirement that your manager comes down and says, we want to perform a role-based security check before every application method. This is to ascertain, are you allowed and authorized to do this operation? And if you're not, reroute the person to a login page. So, you know, the secret word here to look for is every. You know, one of these every or all things must do this or everything must do that. It's a tip-off that it may be a concern that is very broad. Now, there's a problem if you don't modularize cross-cutting concerns. There's two things this can lead to. One of them is called code tangling. This is where, you know, I have a business service like a flight reservation system, and I have the logic for how to make a reservation where I have the list of names and I know how many seats and I need to look up the price. So I've got that business logic that I implement, but I need to before that, I need to embed a little code that's going to do a security check. And then I need to wrap this in a transaction to make sure that, you know, I'm reserving three seats. So I'm going to get all three seats or I'm going to get none at all, you know, if the transaction fails. And, you know, maybe I need to do some, I need to add an audit log message at the end of it, you know, to go log it into a database that I was successful in doing this. What that does is I have this, you know, what used to be a nice clean business requirement of reserving seats, and I've tangled it with other functionality like security and transactions and auditing. So that's where, you know, I've got more than one concern in a piece of code. The other part is called code scattering, where that, you know, I've got this, you know, I have the security check in this method, but then I've got to, if I'm going to implement in every method, I've got to go copy and paste it everywhere in front into every method. And every time I add a new method, I need to remember to put that security check in there. Otherwise, I got a security bug I'm going to be fixing 6 months from now. And then, you know, whenever requirement comes, the thing is it's not a question of if, but when are they going to change that requirement? So they may say, well, we've got some new security rules. Now you have to go everywhere that you implemented that security check and update that code. And that's what code scattering gives you. Well, here's an example of what I've just described here, where, you know, I've got this, you know, I've got this method here where I'm calculating a benefit, you know, some, you know, it's some financial calculations, but in front of it, I've got a security check added in here. So it's, we're mixing stuff together. And then scattering is the case where, you know, here's where I'm doing, you know, I'm fetching an account to edit it, whereas down here I'm looking up dining things, but I need to do the same thing. So this is where I've got duplicate code, and wherever you have duplicate code, you have risk of something being out of arrangement or something. You know, I may update that one, I forget to update this one, and I don't want my manager coming to me and saying we just got overbilled $1 million because there was a security hole that let somebody attack the system. So what I start with is I have different services that I've implemented. You know, banking, customer service, reporting, and then I need to add the security code in there. So I need to put this code through here. The next thing is I got to have transactions. So I got to put this transactional management code in here. You know, then finally I've got some logging code that kind of permeates this stuff. So now I have, you know, in banking service, I have some tangling of concerns here because this stuff has to implement multiple, and then you can see it's scattered across here. So, you know, we got scattering and tangling here as an issue. So what does AOP do for us? What the heck is AOP and what does it do for us? The idea is you go back to the idea that you're going to implement your mainline application logic, but you write something instead of an object-oriented. We look at the defining module of encapsulation is called a class. In AOP, our module of collective functionality is called an aspect. And the idea is we write an aspect to implement a cross-cutting concern, and then to apply the aspect to our application, it's called weaving. So here, you know, we've got our original services up here, but we've defined for these three cross-cutting concerns three different aspects: security, transaction, and logging. And then when we have an AOP tool that weaves it into our code for us, and we get the same net effect. So the idea is I'm writing this and I'm writing that, but the parts where it's mixed together, I don't do that. I have a specialized compiler to do it for me. There's two general ways that it's handled. One is there's a static compiler, and it's from the project. It's the AspectJ project, where there's it actually, you know, you write in the special extension of Java an aspect, and it will statically go modify the class files to apply this, to do this weaving to it. There's also a mechanism to do it dynamically on the fly when you run the app. Okay. Here's a basic requirement. Log a message every time a property is about to change. Now, what are we going to, how are we going to apply this? First, let's start off and create some target object and say, we've got this object that's called simple cache, and here's two setters. We have set cache size and set data source. So, you know, it does other things for us. For instance, it'll, you know, if people do lookups and stuff, we'll cache things. But the idea is we want to somehow log every time somebody hits one of these setter methods. And the idea is instead of going into the setter method and writing our logging code, we're going to instead write an aspect. Let's go ahead and pull it up here since. Okay. There's two ways to write it. One is, I mentioned, this AspectJ compiler. It's an extra installation onto your system. But there's another way to do it called whatever, at AspectJ, which is basically you create a class, but you use some annotations on it, and Spring is able to parse this also. So the idea is it says it's a class, but I've annotated this as an aspect, and I call it the property change tracker. So I'm going to go create a logger, and I have this method called track change. It really doesn't matter what I call it, because the key part is this annotation in front of it called at before. This is a rule for where to apply, where am I going to use this rule? And it says anytime I execute a method that has a signature of void set star with any arguments. So any method that, you know, upon execution of a method that starts with the word set, I don't care what the arguments are, invoke this code before you actually call the setter method. In this case, I'm going to call my logger and print property about to change. Now, there's more detail to this, as in you actually, you can do stuff before, you can do stuff after, and you can also do what's called around, where you have control of the invocation of the actual target method. And you actually have the ability to access, you can look up what is the actual method name, what are the arguments. You can really use a lot of introspection, interrogate a lot about it if you want to. For this simple one, we just want to print it out. For instance, I'd be able to look up what is the method name here, so I can actually put it into my log message. Now the final part is we need to wire up Spring to tell it to spin up this aspect, or go, you know, apply the aspect. And in this case, inside our XML file, we have an extra namespace defined called AOP. And in this case, we're going to use AspectJ AutoProxy. And all I need to do is define this bean here so that when I boot up my Spring-based application, it's going to create these other beans, you know, these caches and stuff, but it's also going to create an instance of this property change tracker. So when it's created, that tag up there means go look for any classes that are annotated with at aspect, grab them, and start applying. That's our test. So it's going to go look for anywheres where the rules apply, and it's going to spin it up for us.
Unfortunately, at that point, we lost power, so I had to finish the slideshow without the overhead, and I was unable to capture any audio from that. We finished by talking about transactions, JVM scripting support, and finally, OSGI. Hopefully, you'll be able to catch our next Nashville Java User Group meeting starting at the first Thursday of the month. For more details, just visit nashvillejug.posterous.com. Pond Jumpers would like to thank the Skype call recorder team, who's made it easy to record Skype phone calls. Please send us any feedback or contact us about any potential interviews. We love talking about anything open source. Visit our webpage at pondjumpers.com, or send us a message through our contact form, or simply email us at contact@pondjumpers.com. All writings and recordings produced by Pond Jumpers are published through a Creative Commons license and copyrighted by Greg Turquist and Russ Miles. The content of this podcast and website does not represent any of the companies mentioned nor their opinions. The intro and exit music is the upbeat Roxanne, Sweet Romana, and purchased from opuzz.com, the site for royalty-free production music.
Working from both sides of the pond, the Pond Jumpers are Greg Turnquist and Russ Miles.